4, 3, 2, 1. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Luke Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hey everybody, it's the Authority Smashers with your host Buddha Gem and Mr. 1001 Nights. Welcome you all to a night of radical politics as we engage in some interesting discussion, I hope. Lots of crazy stuff going on in the world. We'll be talking a little bit about the Honduran coup, democracy, some local stuff with the real estate bubble, the Employee Liberation Act, which I didn't get to last week, and the G20, among other things. So it should be interesting. And we may have a caller from fellow YouTube user Brain Police, which some of you may or may not know. That's kind of in the air still. I had some, there was a possibility I wasn't going to be able to make it tonight. So I wasn't able to confirm whether or not we'd have him tonight. So that could happen later in the show.
I'm glad you did, Buddha Gem.
And of course, you have Mr. 1001. Yeah, I'm glad. I really didn't know if I was going to be able to make it tonight. So. How are you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing pretty good. Just working out some issues here with the documentary that I told you I'm working on.
Could you tell the audience a little bit about the documentary? I don't know if you've mentioned it really.
Yeah,
would you like to mention?
Yeah,
I can. A little bit.
Yeah, we. I decided. I had heard Chomsky talking about the investment theory of politics, which basically argues that blocks of investors control the parties in the United States. And I thought that would be an interesting subject for a lot of people in the United States and other countries who are under the illusion that they control the electoral system rather than businesses. So I went to Boston. This was around March. And I met with fellow YouTube user Chomsky and yourself, Buddha Gem, and we interviewed Thomas Ferguson, the author of the book, and from there I've been working on this documentary. In fact, something funny happened today that we were supposed to actually interview Edward Herman, who is the co-author of Manufacturing Consent and The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism and other books with Noam Chomsky, and unfortunately our fellow YouTube user Chomsky and run into some problems and couldn't make it to the interview, so we didn't get it. But it's an interesting subject. And since we're on that topic, perhaps we could maybe mention the fact that you made a very interesting video a few days ago about the Trilateral Commission. And in fact, I included one of those quotes that you made at the beginning of the documentary. And it's about how the 1960s scared elites. And in the words of Samuel Huntington, the democratic impulse made government more functional. That is, it increases functions, but at the same time decreased its authority, which is sort of like the opposite of what the message that we hear in the media all the time. The more the government, the more that we can make the government do things for us, the more authoritarian it will become. But apparently that's not the perception of the elites who run the country.
Definitely not their perception. Well, what's interesting, though, is it wasn't just the fact that it became more functional. I mean, it certainly a government or a state could become more functional and more authoritarian, but it was that the democratic impulse, the democratic surge, which, again, I have to stress this, I didn't stress it enough in the video, and I got a lot of confusion on this. Democracy is more than voting, everybody. And interestingly enough, as Sam Huntington points out in this report, voting participation declined during the democratic surge. So I want you to wrap your minds around that. Voting went down during the democratic surge. So, of course, what I want you to ask yourselves is, well, what other forms might democracy take? Because that's really what you need to start thinking about. Because people automatically in the comments section started talking about voting and this and that. Voting is one particular form that democracy can take. And as Sam Huntington points out, voting participation declined during the surge, you know, it's really about participation in society. You and I having a say in things that affect us. And people formed groups, coalitions, all kinds of different ways of interjecting their voice and their concerns into the public arena. That didn't always take the form of voting. And in the case of the 60s, actually, voting participation declined. So, yes, it's a fascinating read. And there's a link I will put in the chat room here, the squirrel link that I do. It has a link to the Trilateral Commission report, The Crisis of Democracy. Fascinating read. I urge you all to read it.
And I guess that continuing on the topic of the investment theory, yesterday I had a conversation with a right winger at Borders Bookstore, and he started telling me, he mentioned the fact that in Iowa, apparently the Iowa caucus, Romney outspent Huckabee 15-1. And still won, right? So that appeared to go against the investment theory, though, of course, every other, you know, like 9 out of 10 candidates outspend their opponents. But I found the reason why that was, and that is that Romney is a Mormon, and Huckabee, so Iowa is overwhelmingly Christian, and Huckabee was talking about how Romney would, the Mormons believe that Jesus and the devil are friends or something like that. So anyway, so that's another.
Brothers, I think.
Yeah, that's another reason why the Republicans play they play the religion card in their PR right. battle for power. So obviously, if you spend your money in an unwise way, if I make 1,000 ads that don't turn people on, yeah, that's not going to get you a lot of supporters. But if you have halfway decent PR people that push for certain, like Obama, change, hope, et cetera, all those posters, all those slogans, those things work very well. And they got a lot of people to support his candidacy, even though they were not even aware of the actual policies that he was intending to implement, and in fact fool the people about the kind of policies that he was really going to implement.
Well, yeah, and if you notice, what was brilliant about Obama was he really made himself into this blank slate that you could just kind of, put whatever you wanted on him. So people believed he was anti-war. If they were anti-war, they believed he was this, they believed he was that, even though he was pretty open about his positions, but the PR campaign really created this blank slate of hope and change. And then whatever hope and change you had, you just kind of, put on the canvas of Obama. So that was interesting. But again, I really think we need to emphasize, though, that when we talk about democracy, we're talking about much more than the representative democracy that we have or pseudo-democracy we have in this country. And we're talking about much more than voting. We're talking about participation in society.
And one of the main obstacles to participation is something you mentioned that even us dissidents are deeply influenced by, and we don't like to admit it, but we're deeply influenced by advertising, PR, propaganda, etc. And this is something that always my liberal friends tell me. Well, you always have a choice. It's sort of like, I was just telling you earlier how there's a new report that came out talking about how in 23 states there's been an increase in obesity, right? And we have extremely high rates. And he says, well, it's your choice. You say, you have the choice to refuse to buy the cheap food in the supermarket. You have a choice to refuse to, look at the ads of McDonald's. Look, you have those choices, but how hard are they to pursue? When you day and night you're bombarded by these things, when you have all these pressures, we know that inducement actually in many ways works better than totalitarian control.
We have two callers, and like I said, I was trying to get Brain Police on tonight's show. I just want to see if one of the callers is Brain Police. I'm going to check right now, okay? Mm-hmm. And we'll put him on a little later, but I just want to see if it's him. Hello, Alex?
Yeah, that's me.
Oh, great, great. Alex, would you mind if we waited another maybe 20 minutes?
Yeah, that's
get
fine.
You on? Okay, great. I
No
just want to make
problem.
sure if this was you or not. All right. Thanks, Alex. All right. Great. Yeah, great. So we are going to have Brain Police on tonight. So
Cool.
those of you who watch our YouTube channel, this should be very interesting. We'll be discussing the Stotles character, Ryan. What is he now? The Confederal Socialist? Is that correct?
Yeah, he's been
he's
changing
got a
his
lot of
name, I
different
guess.
channels.
I don't pay that much
Yeah,
attention
I
to
think he
him,
gets.
but he.
Oh yeah. Well, I think the last back and forth you had with him was over the computer. The how the computer came about. Is that right?
This was like 3-4 months. This was a long time ago, but
Yeah. We're not going to be discussing that, but
no. Oh, national anarchism, right? We want our own white anarchist state, sort of idea. Is that the kind
yeah,
of?
Yeah, I don't. You know. Yeah, we'll get into that. Like I said, in about
right.
20 minutes, where we can jump into that.
Right.
So,
right.
So back to democracy. What we say? I'm sorry.
Well, we were starting with the ideas of Huntington, the fear of Huntington
Right.
and other elite intellectuals that more involvement in the government by the people would actually undermine the authority of the elites. And you know, but it's true. Maybe that's not the only way that a democracy can run, and also it's not the only way that governments can also use welfare measures, I'm sure, to pacify the population. You know, you throw them some crumbs, and there's no doubt that by increasing its functions, that is by forcing the government to decline its authoritarian power, to decrease its authoritarian power, the public is winning a small victory. It's not
well.
What?
Can I quote from the report? I have a nice little quote here I'll just share again that I think really captured, because it's more than just undermining the authority of the government. And this is a quote from the Trilateral Commission report from Sam Huntington, and I quote, "The essence of the democratic surge in the 1960s was a general challenge to existing systems of authority, public and private." That's important. I mean, think about that. He goes on, and he talks, I mean, every realm of society, from civil service to bureaucracy to public institutions, private institutions, hierarchy, expertise, these things that people kind of just bowed down to, they were starting to question from the surge in democracy. You know, that's important for anarchists, because we're always wondering, how do we get these people to start thinking? It's participating, it's exercising their freedoms. You know, in various ways. And like I said, again and again, it's not just voting. It's participating. It's being active. It's getting involved in things. All
yeah.
the things that we're always trying to encourage people to do.
I think,
I
mean, and I think that's one of the differences between us and some of the people that reject reformism altogether, and that is that we see in these reformist measures not only something that improves the lives of desperate people, but also something that reflects an anarchist sort of spirit. And because anarchism, like you say, it has a very broad back. You know when you quoted Rudolf Rocker, that it has a broad
yeah.
back. It encompasses a very wide range of ideas, a very wide range of possibilities. And we have. I mean, sort of like you say, I don't have a state smasher. I don't have in the closet something that I can pull and smash the state. I don't have that. So we need to realize we have certain structures in place. How do we undermine them? And participation, democracy, public input seems to be a way of doing that.
Yeah, and again, what I told you earlier before the show is what's most interesting about this report is, again, it's from the elite perspective. They were fearful of this democratic surge. This isn't Noam Chomsky or Mr. 1001 Nights or some, leftist. This is, mainstream, elite opinion, fearful of this surge because it was undermining the authority, their ability to govern. And they talk about the need to marginalize certain segments of the population, and those marginalized segments of the population, blacks and women, for instance, that Huntington mentions, were voicing their opinion, were entering the political arena in various ways. So, you know, and one of the ways working class people historically have done that is through labor unions. You know, you can have all your biases aside, that is a one piece in the democratic puzzle. You know, it's one way in which working class people have been able to enter the political arena in many ways.
So I guess,
and like you said, yeah.
Since we're on that vein of discussing these theoretical issues, which are also connected, of course, to the real events in the real world, maybe we should discuss a little bit about this prevalent notion of the tyranny of the majority, whereby when people get together, inevitably you're going to get some sort of majority, pervasively applied majority rule for every decision. You know, 51 want to kill 49, so the 49 die. Is that what democracy is about?
No. First off, I mean, that's a very real concern in any society, right? To protect minorities. I think any society is vulnerable to that possibility that minorities could be, you know, demonized. As, you know, we saw in World War II, and we've seen in this country, we've seen very, you know, hostile anti-immigration bills pass, attacking a minority element in this society. I mean, you know, these things are very real. And certainly it would exist in any kind of democratic society. Anarchists like Emma Goldman and Errico Malatesta have, and Bakunin and others have written about this very real concern. But does that mean that that's what democracy is? No, I don't think so.
Also, I think it may be important to note that the reason why these minorities are oppressed has a lot to do with an issue of power. When you're a minority, you have less power than a majority, right? Now, the question is, if you have a society which has this in its own consciousness, the idea that power should be checked, that power should be, the burden of proof is on authority. If that is an idea that is in the general consciousness of a people, I think you're much more likely to see our own intrinsic moral sort of instinct come out in order to defend the interests of minorities. And of course, you have people like Michael Albert who say that, you know, we should strive to have a say over decisions in proportion to how much we're affected. And if a minority, say, it's more affected by a certain policy, you know, they should have more say than somebody than a larger number of people. Inevitably, in any society, is going to be conflicts of interest. But our purpose is to try to solve it ourselves. You know, we the people can actually get together and we can work these things out. And that's what a lot of people, you know, end up saying. I mean, the guy I was talking to yesterday at Borders, he just said, you know, people are dumb. They can't decide these things. They need autocrats to tell them how to run things. Otherwise, it'll be a mob. It'll be a tyranny of the majority, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they don't trust people in getting together and working out these decisions in assemblies and other democratic forums.
Right, and one thing I'd like to say too is, if you look back through the history, and that's one of the interesting things about reading, this Trilateral Commission report, reading people like Walter Lippmann, James Madison, and if you look in the link, I actually have the document where you can see the debates where Madison actually does say, you know, the purpose of this government is to protect the minority of the opulent. The minority that they are concerned with is property owners. It is the elite, it is the wealthy, it is the people who own and control this country. As John Jay said, the people who own this country ought to rule it. That is the minority that they're concerned about. They were not concerned about blacks. They were not concerned about, you know, women. They were not concerned about immigrants. They, you know, I mean, when we talk about minorities,
or Native Americans,
one kind of idea. Yeah, Native, you know, they weren't considered about any of these other, you know, it was people who owned property. That was the minority they cared about. You know, so, I mean, it's really important to, you know, have that perspective that when the elite are talking about something, like when they're talking about the crisis of democracy, you know, the crisis of democracy is democracy. That's the crisis, you know, too much democracy. These people are getting out of hand. They're having a voice. They're having a say in how their life and how their society is ran. And that was very scary to them because they were losing authority. They were, you know, and why do they want that authority? Because it protects their class privilege. It protects that minority of the opulent, which is the only minority that they care about. So, you know, it's very important to remember that. And in this, if we could bring this to more recent events, you know, talking about democracy, you know, we have the coup in Honduras, and, you know, there's a great story in the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, if you read the opinion section, is, you know, make you crawl if you're a leftist like me. But, you know, it starts out in a perfect world. Honduran President Manuel Zelaya would be in jail, blah, blah, blah. You know, he violated, you know, let's see what this says here. He trampled over their constitution. You know, having a non-binding, you know, basically like a poll of the citizenry. You know, this is, you know, meanwhile, here in this country, our presidents trample over our constitution on a regular basis. Nobody bats an eye.
Well, we often talk about this, how in the elite media you have certain. I mean, if the candidate had been one that was favorable to U.S. corporations, you know, open door to corporate investment in the country, you know, hand over the country to all these investors and stuff like that, then you would have seen the different coverage. Oh, you know, he was trying to amend all this injustice in the country, and I mean, it's all based. And what's funny about this is that the journalist may actually believe it, because you cannot be a good propagandist unless, you know, like Chomsky says, it's in your bones. You have sort of brainwashed yourself, and so that you don't give us what is called secondary signs. You know, like, it's hard to lie to people, so I believe my own lies, and then, you know, just I can appear like I'm really convinced and I really believe it, and then I'm really convincing. And that's what it is. So you have this sort of dichotomous treatment that when it's serviceable to the interests of the elite, then you have the news, you know, having one standard. And if it had been a coup, I mean, you know, Allende was overthrown. You know, there have been many bloodbaths in, say, during the 1960s and 70s and 80s.
We didn't have to go back that far. We just had, you know, Aristide in Haiti. We had the attempted coup on Chavez in Venezuela. I mean, these things aren't, you know,
Iraq.
Decades ago.
So gonna, throughout history, you see this pattern that when atrocities and elections and coups are for our own advantage, meaning the elite's advantage, then those things are legitimized in the media.
Right. Well, one thing I wanted to, in relation to democracy, though, and it relates to the debate I had with the evil conservative, and I have been in touch with him, everyone, and he's going to get me an edited copy of the debate, so hopefully we can either play it on the show or we can post it on the blog. As soon as I get it, I'll let you guys know. But I mentioned that his argument was basically one of, you know, this legal thing, right? Like, well, the Supreme Court and the Congress, and like, those are the rules. And like, to a lot of people, that's democracy. You know, we got to follow the rules. It's all about following the rules. And democracy isn't about, I mean, you know, we can set up some rules, but those rules can be very undemocratic, as they were with the United States, right? Where, you know, largely, especially when we started out, it was very undemocratic, right? I mean, you basically had, you know, voting was very restricted to males, your own property, blah, blah, blah. The rules themselves can be undemocratic. So it can be democratic to bypass those rules.
Well,
that's the point of the Wall Street Journal article, is that, you know, rules were broken, rules were broken.
Rules are tricky as well, because generally it is the powerful who set the rules, but it's also the powerful who violate the rules the most. So you have this sort of like funny double standard there, because, I mean, take, say, the United States. The United States has a lot of it's like Mexico. Mexico has very nice labor laws. You know, you have the right to do this, the right to do that. But in reality, those rules are not respected. Why? Because real power does not allow it. So you can have it on paper, you know, that's fine. But on the other hand, the biggest violators of rules by far are the powerful. So, you know, for someone like evil conservative who I'm sure supports every violation of international law that the U.S. has committed in the last, 50 years, for him to go out of his way to this other country, Honduras, and start criticizing this, it's obviously extremely fishy. You have to ask, what about the pink elephant in the room? Why don't you talk about that? Why do you go out of your way to talk about Honduras and legitimize this particular thing? I mean, it's obviously... it's obviously propaganda. What can you say?
Well, sure, my major point though is that the rules themselves are not democracy. It's voting every 4 years for the, in our democratic representative democracy that we have. We're essentially ratifying decisions that have been made for us. They pick whether it's going to be Coke or Pepsi, and then they say, okay, you can choose Coke or Pepsi. We're like, I'll go with Pepsi, and then Pepsi screws us, and next election we go with Coke, and Coke screws us, and we go back to Pepsi, they're like, you've got freedom. You can decide Coke or Pepsi for the next 100 years.
It was interesting because when I was debating this right-winger yesterday at Borders, he told me that, I told him that when corporations give to the candidates, they expect to get something back, and that they, in fact... they control these parties to a large extent. And he said, no. They give money to the parties that they think the people are going to elect. And I said, no, if that were true, you wouldn't have certain corporations who give always more to one party. They would give to whichever party they thought it was going to win. This guy was trying to find every argument he could think of.
How does this happen at Borders? How do you... How does this happen?
Well, no,
I try to avoid those kind of things. It's like, oh boy.
He was holding on to the straws just to justify, because he always he actually voted for Obama. He always supported Bush, but this time he voted for Obama. Sort of like he has become sort of a liberal. He said, "Well, I'm turning more into a liberal," and so he just he couldn't accept that his whole ideology was a fraud. That the elections are bought. I mean, just imagine that put so much energy.
Yeah, you gotta be gentle with the guy. I mean, he's making progress, right?
Yeah, that's
maybe in a couple more years, be a radical. Who knows? I mean, it's a process for everybody. Maybe that's kind of cool that he moved in some direction. I think we all evolve in different ways. There's a lot of stuff we haven't been able to get to, but I do want to get Brain Police on here. Do you mind? Yeah, he's been waiting here for a while. I'd love to talk to him. Kind of excited to have him on here.
Let's have him, on.
Cool. Alex, hey, how you doing, buddy?
What's up, guys?
Oh, man, it's good to have you on here. It's funny. A listener was mentioning your video, I think it was The Failure of Conservatism.
Conservatarianism, yes.
Yes. So I went and watched it, and it was interesting in and of itself, but I just so happened to be in the process in the last week or so, I guess, of really kind of delving into the Mises Institute and the people and the, more than just the ideas, but who's actually, writing this stuff and who are the players involved. And I was really kind of taken back, I have to tell you, by, some of the neo-Confederates that are there. I wasn't even aware of the Ron Paul connection. I haven't visited the site a lot, so, some of the stuff you said struck me, because I was like, I'm just kind of learning about this stuff myself. So, that was, very interesting. So,
Some of the stuff I mentioned comes straight from debates between me and people at their message board and stuff like that. And just from, their blog posts, at their blog and stuff. But you're right that, there are neo-Confederates there to an extent, and there are people who promote monarchy and stuff like that. It's kind of sickening to me.
I think I think one of the interesting things that Brain Police mentions is that in every one of these movements, there's always a strain of people that are more authoritarian. So within the leftist movement, you have a lot of people who are sort of neo-Stalinist or Marxist-Leninist, and within the you know, the strain that brain police belongs to, there's people that have these sort of unsavory tendencies as well.
Well, yeah, it's the equivalent of that on the right, basically.
Yeah, and I don't know if we can really put brain police in that. You know, because maybe you could explain your position, or, you know,
I'm basically a mutualist at this point.
A mutualist, okay.
I don't really even, like, believe in, you know, absolute land property and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah, I certainly think that brain police is somewhere in the spectrum of the what you call anarchism without adjectives. But it's interesting that we have all these people that sort of define us as a movement because of their, you know, allegiance to one or another dogmatic extreme of the spectrum.
Yeah. Although one thing that I've been complaining about recently is people who totally exploit the concept of, like, pluralism or anarchism without adjectives to the point of absurdity. This is something me and Laughing Man have been talking about, where, you know, it's like, oh, you could have your little monarchy in anarchism and it's okay. It's like, well, you've just totally exploded the concept to absurdity.
Well, this brings us to Mr. Schodels or Ryan, or how should we refer to him now? I don't know. Ryan? That's his name,
yeah,
right?
That's his real name, apparently, yeah.
Okay, so well, I guess we could refer to him as Ryan. Hopefully our listeners are aware of. He's a very popular anarchist, and I put that in quotes, on YouTube. How long has he been dabbling in anarchism at this point? Are you aware?
About a year. I mean, basically one day he commented on a whole bunch of people's channels, like, oh, I'm an anarchist now, like about a year ago.
Yeah, I remember, because he was all about the IQ charts and white nationalism, and then I was like, ah, I'm an anarchist now. I was like, well, that's an interesting
Here's how I view that. Basically, he saw a way in anarchism, quote-unquote, to legitimize it, basically, by sugarcoating it with the notion of, like, voluntarism, so that right. You could still hold on to those same ideas, but make it more appealing and get rid of that sort of state-associated stigma, but basically keep the same ideas.
And there's actually a movement of these people. Are you aware of these brain police? They're called National Anarchists?
Yeah, the National Anarchists. I've looked a little bit into it.
Yeah, now, does he claim to be part of that, or...
No. He's distanced himself from that, but he still, in my opinion, he appeases them. He still legitimizes it, basically.
Oh, okay.
I think it's important to see this in sort of in a more historical context, because we've seen over and over again people who use terms who previously had some sort of legitimacy and use it for their own purposes in order to legitimize their own authoritarian views. I mean, we see this with, say, the word socialism, which at one point meant sort of workers' control of the means of production and stuff like that. After Soviet Union, came to mean authoritarian, totalitarian.
The state controlling everything. Yeah.
Right. So you have. I mean, throughout history, you've had, or even the term communism. You know, you've had all these terms that because of people like Stoll. I mean, Stoll doesn't have any power, but people who were able to get the power. You know, they use all these terms for their own benefit, and that's something that we always need to fight against. You know, remember in 1984, in that novel, it talks about how it can get to a point where you can't even talk, because every single term that you use to define what you want to say has been taken over by these...
That's his game. That's what Stoddles does. He appeals to... He's like, well, language is subjective, so we could just sort of... shift the meanings of these words however we want. That's basically what he's saying.
What amazes me with Stoddles, and maybe you see this too, Brain Police, is that when he speaks, it's unlike anybody else within anarchism that I've ever heard. You know, he uses these words that no other anarchists use, and these terms that, you know, it's like he's trying to, like, just create this whole lexicon.
Invented his own lexicon.
Yeah, I mean, you hear him talk, and it's like, no other anarchist talks like that. You know, modal anarchy, and what is this whole thing with restrictive covenants, and, you know, all these terms. It's just so ridiculous. And I think you have the same kind of concern that I do with him, is that most of his audience are younger people who are new into these ideas. You know, maybe they're starting to question the state. And, you know, he's playing a very dangerous game because people, one thing he's very good at, I think maybe we'd all agree on this, is he's very good at pretending to know what he's talking about, no matter what it is. I mean, he could be
He comes off as intellectual.
He comes off as
quite intellectual.
Yes, he can be an anarchist for a week, and you think the guy, you know, read every book on anarchism there ever was. You know, he's very good at pretending to know what he's talking about. And I've been wanting to put together a video that really showcases his ignorance on, you know, and I mean, you go on like some of the stuff he did on, you know, he pointed out that there were no German anarchists, there were no Italian anarchists. It's like, what are you talking about?
What?
Oh, yeah. If you go back and watch his videos on, like, libertarian socialism or the crazy Communists, he goes through this whole thing where he tries to, you know, he goes, I don't know what was with all these communist anarchists coming around. And he goes, you know, they didn't develop in Germany and they didn't develop in Italy. And really profound ignorance of the topic he's trying to talk about. And I've seen this again and again in his videos where, you know, but at the same time, he's very good. You know, if you don't know any better, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about, you know, which is very scary, you know. And I think, you know, it's something, you know, do we address it? You know, because then it gets into these petty squabbles that we've seen on YouTube. I don't, you know, what do you think's a good way to address this?
I don't know. I mean, in terms of, like, history, I mean, he's totally off base. I mean, you can just put all the historical facts together, and his ignorance is staring everyone in the face. But when it comes to these younger people who are just coming into this, he's basically duping them, in my opinion. And I feel bad about it because these people are mean well, I think, for the most part.
Oh, sure.
And they're just like, he's quote-unquote converting them into this very superficial, like, well, ideology of, like, anti-statism, in which all that matters, like, this philosophy he's promoting is, well, if people just superficially drop the idea of the state, then we could sort of ignore everything else. And to me, that's incredibly dangerous, because it's like, okay, well, then a bunch of nationalists and, you know, patriarchy and all these other concerns become irrelevant just because someone opposes the state. I think that's very superficial.
Yeah, and as anarchists, I mean, we've always been, you know, at least tried to be holistic, you know, and approaching all kinds of, you know, exploitation and oppression and, you know, all these things. Not that we can, not that any one of us can tackle all those things at once, but all those things are of concern. And being just anti-state isn't enough to, you know, address those things.
I agree with that. The viewpoint in terms of libertarianism, the view that's been called thick libertarianism, this guy named Charles Johnson wrote an article about it in which he puts forward this concept, and he says libertarianism should be thickened to the point where we do have these concerns about cultural values, where we don't just oppose the state, we oppose oppression of women, we oppose racism and stuff like that. And just because just reducing everything to political and economic concerns kind of misses the big picture.
I think that overcoming the deceit of people like Stotles is part of the process of actually becoming anarchist. So we could actually look at him like a stepping stone, kind of a, you know, it's a difficult one to overcome because a lot of people, like you say, they come into the movement, they're interested in the ideas, and then they encounter people like him and then maybe diverted into these, you know, these authoritarian points of view. There's no shortage of people that are going to try to deceive others about anarchism or libertarian ideas.
Yeah, there's no shortage, but, you know, this is kind of where we do a lot of stuff here on YouTube. And on YouTube, I've been, you know, he is one of the more subscribed anarchists, again, in quotes. So I think it's something to at least think about in terms of, you know, addressing that audience that is falling into that, and you know, making videos in response. I know, Brainpolice, you had a back and forth with him and another user, Reign of Radness, right?
Yes.
Was that? Yeah.
That was when I was questioning the national anarchism thing. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say I watched quite a few of those, and I thought you did a really good job in challenging a lot of the things that he was saying. But again, it came down to this idea that words could mean anything, and really kind of disheartening.
There's that, and then there's just an appeal to like amoralism, I guess. Those are the two main things. They argue from, well, morality doesn't exist.
That's a big thing with that other guy, right? The Reign of Radness.
Yeah, Reign of Radness is big on that.
Yeah.
And it's just like, well, I don't know. It just seems kind of like, where are you getting at? Like, what do you have left at that point? Like, what basis do you have to even argue for anti-statism?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, what is it? I saw there was another guy who, I can't remember, another YouTube user was all about that. Like, anarchism's all about morality, and morality doesn't exist, so anarchism is retarded kind of thing.
I'm not sure.
I don't know how these people... Yeah, I can't think of the guy's name, but I just wonder how these people live their lives,
I see your hypocrisy in it, though, because on the other hand, you'll see them turn around and make these arguments that, like, implicitly, it's a hardcore propertarian ethical viewpoint that's implicit in these arguments. And then they'll turn around, and it's only when other people call them on their bullshit that they back to this amoralist position, like, oh, morality doesn't exist, it doesn't matter. And then they'll turn around and start preaching to people about the necessity of property and stuff like that, and it's like, well, it seems quite two-sided to me, the way I've observed it.
Yeah, we get this double standard that morality is okay when I talk about it, but no when you talk about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, they might not explicitly talk about morality, but it's implicit in the arguments about, they'll argue, taxation is theft and stuff like that. And it's like, even if we agree with those arguments, it's an implicit moral argument in there. And then you'll turn around when someone else calls you on your inconsistency, you'll back off and be like, oh, morality is, non-existent. And I think that's quite hypocritical.
Yeah, to say the least. Do you interact at all anymore with Ryan?
No, he blocked me after that big conflict. So I don't interact with him directly, but he made a video directed towards me on some side account the other day, telling me that I'm pandering to authoritarian leftists. I'm not. I put forward my sincere views on these matters, and I myself fall somewhere into the leftist spectrum, especially on these cultural questions.
I can vouch for that. You've certainly never pandered. You've always held your ground and, made your case. That's one of the things I've always appreciated about dealing with you and another user like Punk Outlaw, we don't always agree, and that's fine, but certainly there hasn't been any pandering. It's been like, well, this is what I think, this is why I think it, and I think that's respectful, so.
Yeah, with me and Punk Outlaw, I think part of it was, the attempt to just remove some of the hostility, I guess.
Sure. Remembering that we're all people, right?
Right, and then that's another thing, though. It's like, not even, forget about the whole anarchism thing. It's just, as a person, if you can't stand up and see what's wrong with racism and patriarchy, you have some backwards thinking to work out, just as a person.
Sure.
You don't have to be an anarchist to fucking have problems with that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's one thing, in regards to Ryan, I wonder, does he still hold these beliefs about his pseudoscience and his IQ stuff? Do you know if that's him? Oh, okay. Yeah. So,
he pushes it. He pushes it on his side accounts, though. But yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, so he's still pushing those videos. Are still around on YouTube?
Yes. He just relegates it to different accounts, from what I've gathered.
Yeah, and he seems to be. This is just my impression. I don't really have any evidence of this, but it seems like he really puts a lot of effort into garnering new subscribers.
Yes, he admits he subwhores, basically. He
yeah.
goes out of his way to try to get as many subscribers as possible. It almost seems like as if he's, you know, trying to win some popularity contest.
Yeah, I remember for a long time he would, I don't know if he still does it, he would, you know, his channel would be from, like, you know, Scotland or New Zealand, so he'd get, like, you know, most subscribed and all these things, and he'd get all these honors that were meaningless, you know, because there was, like, no one else from that country doing it, so...
Overall, we have to keep in mind that all of us are still getting very few subscribers as compared to people who talk about Britney Spears and stuff like that. I mean, there's people who have, like, you know, a few hundred thousand subscribers that, you know, talk about nonsense. So I think most people that, but it's true, people who talk about serious stuff on YouTube tend to get fewer subscribers. So we should be
concerned. I think that's kind of just the medium. I mean, I know for a long time I didn't know that there was serious stuff on YouTube. You know, my experience with YouTube, every once in a while someone would email me a link to some goofy video of a cat falling down some stairs. That's all I thought it was. You know, when I stumbled across political videos, I was like, oh, wow, you know. So I'm sure there's lots of people out there who are made very serious, very political, just don't even know the stuff's on here, you know. You know, it's just the way it's advertised. You know, when people think of YouTube, they think of, like, silly, goofy videos, you know, the viral videos that are so popular. So I think that's just the nature of the medium. And as far as, like, the numbers of subscribers, you know, I'm much more interested. If I got two or three people who are going to, you know, become dedicated to something serious, you know, go out in their communities and do something, I'd be much more impressed with that than having 10,000 people who just watch my videos and go off and play video games all day, you know?
Sure.
So, you know, I mean, it's much more about creating a real connection. I mean, like with Jonathan and Chomsky and, you know, I've created those real connections in the real world. So, you know, to me, that's important as opposed to some, you know, 20,000 subscribers.
So, yeah, we actually got together and we did stuff, so it's good.
Yeah. How many subscribers do you have, Brain Police? Just curious.
I'm inching towards 2,000 slowly.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'm pretty surprised about it as it is. Yeah?
Yeah, I think I'm on 1,300 now.
I just want to emphasize, it's not like I'm in some kind of subscriber war with Stuttles or anything. It's
I didn't think that at all. No.
Yeah, but it just bothers me that it seems to me that he goes out of his way to try to get as much attention and popularity as possible.
I wonder how that works. I mean, do you really think, like, someone who just subscribes because you subscribe type thing, are they really watching
the
video?
Sub for sub things.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, how effective is that? Like, really, when that happens, is that person really, or now, they're subbed you, but are they watching your videos?
Yeah, probably that's a good question.
You know? I mean, how many of those subscribers are actually watching his video? You know, that's kind of the question I would have.
That's true, but he has gotten more and more popular.
That's no doubt. And he certainly, I get a lot of people who watch my videos and say, you know, basically, like, I should debate Confederate Socialist about this. I should debate Ryan, you know. I wonder what Ryan would say, as if he was, like, the de facto, anarchist know-it-all.
He's viewed as, like, a know-it-all authority on the matter for some people.
Within a year, right? He said,
yeah.
In 1 year, become an anarchist expert. So
yeah, but it's, like, when it comes to, like, at least classical anarchism, he doesn't know a dime about what he's talking about. I mean, he only knows about... Specifically, most of his sources comes from the Mises Institute, and he doesn't know about, you know, Bakunin or Kropotkin or Proudhon. I mean, and it really pissed me off when he made that video about libertarian. He made a video about the libertarian left, and he made a video about libertarian socialists. And I'm associated with the Alliance of Libertarian Left, and he just totally strawmanned us. He's just like, oh, you know, they're basically on the level of Stalinists. It's like, actually, most of us are, like, somewhere along the lines of mutualists.
Stoles will continue to be a source of, interest, I guess.
I guess it's not just about him, though. I've seen some conflicts on online about the whole national anarchism thing in general.
That's a real deal, yeah. That's been a big issue among anarchists, because... They're coming to, you know, book fairs, and they're pretty open about their wish to infiltrate and disrupt, other anarchist groups. So, yeah, that's a real concern.
From what I've read up on it, yeah. Some of them actually try to, it's really deceptive. I've seen them identify as libertarian socialists and stuff like that. They'll use working class rhetoric to try to get people on board with them.
Yep.
Sound familiar?
No, yeah, they're very... Yeah, they are. I think as far as Stolz goes, I don't think we have to worry about him getting too far from his computer. I don't get the feeling that he really goes outside and does things.
Yeah, so
I could be wrong.
So Buddha-tum, you want to go?
It takes a lot of time to like sub for everybody. But I'm sorry.
Do you want to go into a music break?
Hey, Alex, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us.
Thanks,
I really appreciate it. Yeah, no, hopefully we can have you on again sometime. Would that be cool?
Yeah, that's fine with me.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Alex. Have a great night, buddy.
Yeah, nice talking to you guys.
Have a good one.
Definitely. Bye-bye.
So you want to play music for a minute, and then we can cover a little bit of more news?
Sure. You want to go into a Gorilla Radio for you here. Stop us now. We don't have much time left in the show, guys. Junior Pig said I could lecture you guys on, on how silly and self-sacrificial we're being and going to the G20. Johnson, you want to talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, the G20 is coming up this September, and I would encourage anyone who's in the area to go down there and try to demonstrate and fight against this gathering of elites, which is going to happen there. It looks pretty promising. There's going to be a lot of people from around the country and maybe even around the world going there. And as it happened during the Democratic and Republican conventions, there's going to be a highly organized body of police, a corps, you know, it's trying to keep away the demonstrators from the places that matter, and restricting their movement and so on. So it's going to be, if people want to experience and what, you know, some real sort of hands-on experience on what our state is really about and what it does to protect the elite and so on, this is a very good opportunity to actually get a real experience demonstrating, doing something that is going to maybe even allow you to meet other people in the movement as well.
Right. And, you know, if you're new to these types of things, definitely, you know, get involved with some people who have a little, you know, experience, you know, things to bring, what to wear, you know, have close friends with you, all that stuff. You know, and I put an article in that, I don't know if you read it, Mr. 1000 Nights. It's about, you know, the guy says, I'm going to the G20, but I don't know why. And I think if a lot of people are honest, that's probably the opinion of a lot of people. You know, what do you think of it as a tactic?
I think it definitely can be very very fruitful. It's you know, it certainly beats not doing anything. I mean, you know, these demonstrations over time do have an effect, and now it's hard to see the immediate results. But it's sort of like you push for something, and then once again, it forces the authorities to react in some way, you know, to say, hey, you know, we can't just get away with doing anything. I mean, there's a reason why, say, a lot of these economic summits, like, say, the NAFTA and all these things, they try to be as far away as they can. Sometimes they go as far as going to some island somewhere in the Pacific or whatever, because they... Mm-hmm. They know that the people hate them. They know that the people are not in favor of these policies, so they have to run away. Now that's that. We gotta keep them on their toes. Okay, we can't just say, okay, you know, it doesn't matter either way. So let them just do it in New York or some major city or something. No, I mean, we really gotta push them out of sight. And that's how you build, you know, on top of course, maybe meeting other people and going on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have a little different take, but I think that's an important part of it, is developing the links with other activists and anarchists and anti-authoritarians, whatever they're going to call themselves. That's one of the great things about getting involved in these things, is you develop those ties with people. You know, and hopefully when you leave the event, when you leave the summit, you keep those ties and you strengthen them and you nourish them. That's really important, because it's those, you know, it can't all be done on the internet, folks. It's got, you know, you got to have real physical ties to people. And that's one of the benefits of something like the G20. And not only that, but I think it strengthens your convictions when you show up and you see, you know, hopefully thousands of anarchists, you know, hundreds of anarchists. You know, it makes you realize, like, yeah, I'm not the only one, you know, because, you know, some of you live in suburbs or different, you know, places in the country. You may feel like you're the only anarchist in the world. So, yeah, if you're not in the United States, I mean, I know we have listeners from, you know, other countries. You know, it's very easy to feel isolated. So these events can be very empowering, you know, and, you know, remind you you're not alone.
I mean, it really does... sort of bring out the bold, the radical, and the rational in you, because very often when you stay alone, and you know, I think we all do this because it's a tendency that is just in our system. You know, we're isolated and so on. But when you get out there and see others doing stuff, and you are in that atmosphere, you come back as a different person. It really transforms you. I mean, and we must stress how collective action, collective consciousness really affects the individual. And that's part of the process. And that's, you know, also part of the process of knowledge and understanding of you know, everything that we see around us.
You know what else that is? That's democracy. You know, that's democracy when you're challenging power. And that process of democracy, acting in that way, will get you and others to start. It'll undermine authority. You know, and that's something we can't forget. That is democracy in action. You know, all the protesting. Remember, it's not just voting, folks. It's us taking to the streets and letting our voices be heard. That's what democracy looks like. Don't forget it. And I hope, you know, you guys will join the struggle in any way you see fit. So I hope you guys will get active and get involved. Anything else, brother?
That's it. Keep up the good fight.
Oh. Yeah, keep up the good fight, people. We'll see you next Tuesday. Same bat time, same bat channel. All right? So thanks, everybody, for coming by. Really appreciate it. Have a great night, okay?